what is really going on, Crypto Savages. This is your host, C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief out of coinspice.io, back with another episode of the CoinSpice podcast. And this episode I have Shiv Malik. He is probably best known for his investigative journalism work with The Guardian, being involved in a rather nasty speech imbroglio between he and the government of the UK over sources a few years back. That actually has led to a book, which I can't wait to read, that should be out in June, called The Messenger. But today I've got Shiv on because he has basically broken open what I consider to be the debate in cryptocurrency, which is over Zabel's Law, or best known as, I guess, Coda's Law. This idea of whether or not investors, developers, users should be more inclined towards appeasing governments and being legal, or whether we should be outside of government control. That is the debate. So if you're, you know, not into Ethereum and you're thinking, oh, this doesn't apply to me, I like Bitcoin Cash, we are debating that right now as well. Dash is debating it, EOS, everybody's debating, especially with regulators looming all over the world, how much is too much, where and when should we appease the government regulators and get in line with them, whether we want to be just another PayPal or just another, you know, database. It's all a fantastic debate that I think is really a first mover. You know, it's kind of hard to decide what you're doing if you can't reconcile this issue. So Shiv Malik is the guest today. Fantastic thinker. You're really going to like the episode. I learned a ton. So sit back, grab yourself a tall, cool glass of milk. Now, if that's, you know, if you're vegan and you want to do the whole almond soy thing, I'm not going to judge you. That's awesome. But it's going to get spicy. Without any further ado, here is Shiv Malik.
What is really going on, Crypto Savages? You are listening to the CoinSpice podcast with host C. Edward Kelso, editor-in-chief at coinspice.io, your home for spicy crypto things on the net.
Writing, I don't want to lie and say I go all the way back to The Guardian, but I've read your stuff, some Medium articles, and your recent take on governance and crypto through a fantastic sort of longer form, let your hair down outlet in the space, Breaker Mag, was just an unbelievable piece, which we'll link to in the show notes for this episode. But it really kind of gets to the heart of what crypto is, as far as I'm concerned. And it's a debate everybody's having, regardless of the blockchain or the crypto that you're particularly partisan to. But before we get on to that, for people who are not familiar with your work, how do you come to crypto and kind of your background?
Well, that's incredibly kind of you to say. I'm glad the piece made an impact. So I've been a journalist for about 15 years. So I started back in sort of 2002, 2003, I did some war reporting in Afghanistan and Pakistan back at that time, which was fun and probably way too dangerous. It's so dangerous that I didn't quite realize, being like 23 and just like going off to Kabul. And then I specialized in terrorism reporting for a while. Then I was an investigative journalist for The Guardian. I wrote a book on economics and then a subsequent book on sort of terrorism. We might get into this personal relationship with the source. And then in about sort of truncating the story a bit, in 2016, I left The Guardian and wanted to write a book on digital cooperatives. I didn't quite know that it was that, but I knew it was about cooperatives. And at the end of the book, I was trying to find this solution for, it's what's known as, and we won't get into it now perhaps, but it's sort of the sacrifice issue, which is how do you start a cooperative, right? Who puts the first sort of, you know, half a million of investment down? Because obviously if everyone owns it, then it's very difficult. And actually it turns out ICOs are basically solve that problem, that issue. They're a really clever mechanism for doing that. And so I fell into this, down this rabbit hole of research, and then at one point started trading, much now to my horror, looking back, I was trading XRP for like a couple of weeks and made a ridiculous amount of money. I just happened to come in at the right time, 2017 May. I wouldn't obviously now buy XRP by any means. It's like, I feel soiled still.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Not that I want the XRP army on my back, obviously, but there we go. And then, but I'd already heard about Ethereum at this point, and I thought it was just an amazing thing, the kind of smart contract. The reason why I sort of really sort of thought this was brilliant is because I thought one day I won't have to do my taxes, because a smart contract will just know everything already, and it's like that would just be easy. And then I realized, obviously, there's a lot more to it than that, and realized the space is full of very fascinating people, and actually many of them looking to make digital cooperatives. So I worked a little bit for Golem, 6 months I kind of worked with them and worked for them, and then I'm with the project that I am with now. It's called Streamer, where I do sort of, I'm their sort of chief evangelist, if you want, and it's a project on data, and it's absolutely fascinating. I'm loving every second of it.
Yeah, I was kind of peeking in there through Medium articles, and it is actually really, really interesting. But along this route of when you come into the ICO idea, over the last 12 years, you've actually been involved in kind of a saga, which is not directly related to what we're going to talk about. But I really do believe that for people to understand issues of governance, you must, and this sounds terrible, but you must understand the bluntest instruments of state power. And for those who haven't experienced it, you know, it becomes a salon issue, a cheeky thing that we can all talk about and so on. It's very different when you're on the business end of a truncheon, as it were. So, If you could kind of talk about your book, The Messenger, which I cannot wait for it to come out. It's coming out in June, right?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
And kind of sort of the kind of the back of the envelope outline of how that leads into your Breaker article.
So the story at the heart of that is I kind of met this very famous British jihadi who had turned his back on the jihadi movement. So this is now 2006, 2007, 2008, in the aftermath of the July 7th bombings in London. And he was, you know, a really fascinating character. And he said, look, you know, I've turned my back on all of this. I really want to write a book. Can you help me do that? So I became his ghostwriter. And then a couple of years into writing that book, roughly about the time when it was, you know, the first draft was due to be handed in, my editor was calling me because I was inevitably a couple of months late already. The police turned up at my door. And what they said was, look, we are investigating your source, the guy that you're writing this book about. We, interestingly, still believe him to be perhaps a member of Al-Qaeda. But more importantly, we want all of your notes. And not just notes that you've derived from interviewing this guy, but all your notes ever, going back for as long as we ask, and we want it all. Notes, recordings, anything you've ever done, we want it all. And obviously as a journalist, this is a horrific thing, like, because I have to betray sources, and some of them, right, you know, were confidential sources. You don't want to do that. So I had to fight this. And I got the backing, actually, of the Journalists Union in the UK and a couple of free speech organizations. And, you know, you don't realize the power of this stuff, like solidarity in that sense, where people stand for these principles and say, no, we will help you and we will help you fight this. Actually, in the Sunday Times stepped in as well.
Oh, wow.
Which was wonderful. And, you know, in the end, the law fee, the fees for the courts cost about, you know, £250,000. It's, you know, wow. $350,000. So it wasn't cheap. And they fought the police. But at one point I realized, you know, at the end of this, it went up to, you know, the second highest court in the land, if you want, just below the Supreme Court, effectively. they said, look, you know, you've lost. We don't agree with you. You have to hand over your stuff to the police. They modified the order, so they didn't have to give over everything, just, you know, what was salutary, if you want, to their investigation. And that was really difficult. You're like, but I, you know, the period of kind of rational debate had ended. And I realized that if I didn't do this, the only other option was for me to go to prison. And I did think about that. I thought, no, I really stand by these principles. Journalists don't give over. You know, no one was accusing me of doing anything wrong. They just wanted my property. They wanted to inspect it. And they wanted to confiscate it from me. And I found this utterly galling. But in the end, you know, if you're not willing to go to jail, then you have to roll over. And that was really difficult. It took me years really to recover my confidence again in principle and values. And actually that solidarity was desperately important to me, because I don't think if I had that, I wouldn't have understood what these values really meant. You know, and I've come up against this a number of times. You know, I've been in protests where you've been hit by the police, fine. But I've also been thrown out by the government of Jordan. I was, doing an investigation on their sort of dirty dealing when it came to arms. The arms that were supposed to go to the Syrian opposition, but in fact they were selling them on to Al-Qaeda. A really big, important public interest story. And of course, I arrive in Jordan and they throw me out of the country. And there's nothing, you know, this is what we call, this is really important, the monopoly on violence. States are given this, right? States are given this monopoly on violence because going back to Hobbes, Hobbes says, look, you know, we have a kind of implicit contract, if you want. You know, the state looks after our security, and we therefore don't have to be armed with, you know, weapons and if you want, look after our own security. We hand over that.
We need this Leviathan state, right? We need this. We need the bully's bully, if you want.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And you know, it gets really interesting when states then go, or you know, movements, even democratic movements, say, okay, look, well, when we seize control of the state, we're going to use it to raise taxes to do this, right? And if you don't do that, we'll put you in prison. Or we're going to use it for corporate lobbying, and we're going to change all the rules. And if you don't like that, tough, we're going to put you in prison, because we own the monopoly on violence. So that for me is, I think, a really fundamental point about governance in terms of the individual and the state. If you don't understand that relationship, and if you certainly never come up against it, you'll never really understand what it means to be governed, in my opinion.
No, that's exactly right. And I think for crypto enthusiasts, they have to begin to understand sort of the basic premise, as I would advocate it, is that this is birthed out of the cypherpunk crypto anarchist movement, and is by definition, no matter you know where you fall, Bitcoin, for lack of a better phrase, kind of like tissue or Coke or Nike, Bitcoin is against the law. I mean, if you're advocating as a currency, especially in the United States, there's only one currency allowed, which is the fiat that is allowed by, or that is you know, put forward by the United States government. And so there's automatically, as soon as you're dealing in this stuff, again, I'm being overly general now, you're almost automatically breaking the law. You're certainly operating outside of it, whether it's extrajudicial. I think we can definitely debate, but there's nothing there. You know, what you're doing is, this could not be created within the confines of the law, as far as I understand its development. So right away, it is an kind of a pirate outsider's idea. Now, where it goes from there, you know, we're 10 years into this idea, is anybody's guess, but I do feel like the foundations, if you go back and you kind of look at how it was sort of worked out, I think that's more or less irrefutable. But so I think you've really hit on something, and that kind of leads us to what's popularly known as Szabo's Law, Code is Law, and Nick Szabo. Can you talk a little bit about who Nick Szabo is, in case people don't know?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of the original cypherpunks, if you want. In that sense, he's also got a legal background, which I think also makes his take really interesting. It was actually another person we'll come to in a second within the Ethereum community who coined this term, if you want, Szabo's Law. Right. And what that basically states is something like this, that the protocol for Bitcoin or Ethereum or any cryptocurrency, if you want, should only be used in a very technical way. So when you're changing the underlying protocol, those updates should just be technical in nature and nothing else. Because if you try and do something else, like let's say, change the immutability of the chain history to reverse and give people back funds that they may have otherwise lost, then you're doing something else. Then you're doing a form of kind of governance, and you shouldn't get into governance. You should just stick to code as law. What's already written is written. It's done, it's done. And if you're going to update stuff, let it only be for technical reasons.
Right.
That's basically is, if you want, is kind of inferred by this. It's a, you know, I think it's only now enshrined as a law, you know, like Moore's law, if you want.
Exactly. It's not, right. not an actual, you know, canonical judicial legislative thing that we can all go look up and has a penal code, but a law in the sense that, well, Szabo's argument carries a lot of weight within the community, but also there's a somewhat of an appeal to authority, at least for a little while. People actually thought Nick was Satoshi, right?
Yeah, there is that. Those theories. I mean, it is interesting as well, right? That the person who started Bitcoin was themselves anonymous and made themselves anonymous,
right?
And for a very good reason, right? Because the thought being that they were, they'd be scared of starting something like this. Because it would be, in fact, illegal. So they took themselves out of that loop, and you yep. start off with this anonymous founder, right? So it can't, no individual could be held liable, if you want, for being the creator of Bitcoin. That's very clever, very smart.
And there's a whole bunch of anecdotal evidence that suggests when the pseudonymous creator of Bitcoin gets wind that Gavin Andreessen, who's kind of in the inner circle at the time and has been emailing back and forth with Satoshi. Satoshi gets wind that Gavin's going to go speak to the CIA and kind of debrief them about all these. Yeah, that's it. I'm done. You guys clean up. I'm out. and like the Christ figure, he's Satoshi's gone, and he's left his followers to kind of deal with the mess. So there's code as law. Steel manning that, or I should say, so that gets us to Ethereum and Ethereum's grown into the source of ICOs. It's become the smart contract hub. It's constantly talked about whether it's a security or not, and there's some recent debate about from people are reading the tea leaves from our Securities and Exchange Commission here in the U.S. that it's not, or they don't believe it is. And, mm-hmm. So it's a constant debate, but a bigwig in the Ethereum development community, Vlad Zamfir, he pens just a few months ago, right? He posts. It's actually a very thoughtful piece, but he posts sort of a scathing rebuke of Szabo's law and the sort of the perniciousness, the viral nature of it, and how it's kind of weaseled its way into arguments within the community there against Szabo's law. Can you steel man Vlad's argument for a second before we go into sort of your position?
Yeah, basically, look, I met Vlad a couple of times. He's a really fascinating character, and I think it's feels safe to say, at least for me, his intentions are in the right place. I just think his arguments are horribly wrong on so many ground level issues. So what he says is this. He says, look, we've got governance issues. He's absolutely right about that. Like, we've got problems that are already there. It's no point trying to say that they're not there. So, for example, the freeze of the parity funds, if people aren't familiar with this, basically a kind of library was deleted, creating the parity wallet funds to be frozen basically forever. Right. Someone decides to go back and fork Ethereum and unfreeze those funds. So that's one issue. So that's a retrospective thing. And here's another governance thing, which is that, look, if we want to, we've got this thing in Ethereum where we don't have enough money to go around to fund new projects, which are really exciting. So, Bancor raised 150 million in the hot ICO period or something like that, like hot right. ICO period of 2017, and actually Uniswap comes along with $100,000 with a grant from the Ethereum Foundation and managed to completely like blow them out of the water. So there are new ideas coming along. How do you fund those? How do you fund also the core protocol and that all of that work? And definitely, do you need to raise some kind of a tax or inflation funding or something like that? How do we even do that? How do we make choices then about what protocols are then? Because it turns out they're not all just technical. Some of them need to get more complicated and interesting because there's more forms of human coordination going on. Like, how do you make choices about that? Whose preferences matter? Is it just some kind of technocracy out of the pages of Kurt Vonnegut's Piano Player? Is it like an oligarchy? Is it a plutarchy? Because, like, you know, you just have a lot of ETH and you stake it all and therefore you're always the winner with the biggest say. Like, you know, how do you do all of it? So Vlad's right to raise all of that. What he says though is this, and it's an unnecessary step, is that we also need to be legal. And so Szabo's law really conflicts with being legal, right? If you wanna just ignore and say, look, the code is law, then you can't really be legal in the sense that like, and I once did it like this, how do you be legal in, you know, in Switzerland, right, which is where lots of projects are. There are projects right. connected. Obviously, they register as legal entities because they need to rent, you know, in a building.
Right.
Right. In Zug or, you know, in the US, San Francisco, Berlin, like, you know, who owns the Ethereum trademark, right? Because if you don't own it, then someone else in the, you know, in the non-software, non-blockchain Web3 world, someone else will just take that and rip it off, right? Yep. No one obviously owns the Bitcoin trademark, so maybe you don't need that, right? Would be the retort. So how do you do all of this stuff, right? How do you, you know, we're going to be legal, he says, let's be legal and let's make blockchain legal. So Szabo's law's got to go. It's got to go because it's antithetical to legality.
And just to jump in, this is not a debate that's only happening on Ethereum, although I do tip my hat to the community because it's certainly more articulate than ours. That involves ad hominems. our side is kind of childish in this regard, but we have...
I don't know. You know, it was very... I just got to interrupt you by saying the tempers are getting frayed and it is becoming palpable. Like,
I was just
going
to say.
FCC in Paris was... it was hot. That's why I wrote the piece because I was like, you know, it's time to put oars in and at least... you know, not have kind of backbiting, just make it plain and open and try and have an intellectual, honest intellectual debate.
Well, you summarized it perfectly because you were considered, you being the broader Ethereum community, you guys were considered the, you know, sort of the adults in the room and the nice guys. You know, if you're tired of the Bitcoin Cash idiots, you know, and Bitcoin Core knuckleheads going at each other, you know, come over here where the water's warm. And the ICOs, you know, the ICOs are deep. I have found that we had a chain split happen in November, and now we have a community of former Bitcoin cashers, what we call big blockers, going out and making this argument, not Vlad's argument in total, but essentially the spirit of Vlad's argument, which is that we got to be legal. And furthermore, we have a guy who's just his company's amassing patents, or as he calls them, patents, and you know, they're you know calling everybody else who does anything remotely outside of what this project considers kosher to be, you know, in violation of the law. They're going to sue everybody. There's a lawsuit actually right now pending. So this is not something that we're unfamiliar with. So anyway, that's why I think it's so important to go into how now you critique it. And I think your piece is something that is gonna be a document for us to refer to over and over again as to how to frame this model. Of course, I agree with you, so that helps. But I'm saying that you've actually outlined it very, very well. So now, there's so many quotable passages, but rather than do that, I'll just kind of hand it back to you. So essentially, what's your problem with Vlad? And you know, let's be legal. Let's embrace Theresa May. Let's go off and see what we can do with the Trump. I love putting it that way, by the way. The Trump Attorney General. You know, let's you know, kumbaya. What's the big deal?
I mean, I find that kind of toadying of the worst kind, and I kind of want to ask Vlad and sort of in the piece try and do so indirectly, but maybe on this I can do it more directly. It's like, do you have any clue what it is to like come up against the state? Have you actually challenged power yet? Because if you haven't challenged power, then you have then what do you really know of what it means to stand up for something while someone is trying to stop you from doing that? And that person has, you know, police, courts, or all sorts of ways of undermining you, covert and overt. You know, these things are real. And then, you know, some of the stories, if you want, I can deploy as evidence, right? First of all, journalists, investigative journalists especially, my you know, original brethren,
right?
They get bumped off all the time. They get killed in Malta, of all places, right? For just exposing the truth, nothing more, not challenging, not trying to set up a competition to any of these corrupt players. Just trying to say, look, this is what people are doing.
Yeah, I'll see your bet, and I'll double down here a little bit. We have Chelsea Manning, who's gone to jail, over refusing to even cooperate with a grand jury. And so she went away for X amount of years during the Obama administration, which is considered over here. He is saintly, progressive, you know, the tears.
Sure.
He is the man, right? And he sent her to a cage and actively hunted Snowden and on and on and on and on and on. So, so I'm sorry. You're right to definitely realize. So you're saying that being on that blunter side really opens you up.
Right. I mean, what in that sense, what does it mean to be legal? What does it mean to say, this is the other half of the argument, if you want. So on one half, it's like, look, are you willing to put your hands up if anyone's willing to go to jail to keep the Ethereum network online, right? And my feeling would be that no one would put their hand up, not overtly, right? And if you look back in history, you know, there are plenty of protest movements, radical movements who've sought freedom from colonialism or civil rights or the suffragettes, you know, people who just want to express themselves, but the law stands against that expression and those rights, right? Who've had to understand what it means to go, you know what, okay, I'm going to either redistribute the monopoly on violence and we're going to become violent ourselves, right? The suffragettes, people forget about this. The suffragettes and the suffragists were two separate movements, and one believed in violence.
That's right.
Usually not against the person, more against property, but nonetheless.
But also same with Malcolm X versus Martin Luther King, right?
Right, right. Good. Another good example. And, you know, the Indian movement against British colonialism had to learn to be nonviolent in a very specific way. Right, and this is what I think the genius of that movement was. It was nonviolent whilst actively bringing out the violence of the state upon themselves. And I think that's a fascinating way of going about things, but that takes extraordinary amounts of discipline to basically stand there and allow yourself to be beaten in the name of your own freedom, right? No one in the Ethereum network is ready for any of this, right?
Sure.
You know, if you're gonna really challenge power, if you're really doing something kind of interesting, no one is ready to even accept that they might have to go to court and stand in court, let alone be prosecuted for anything. Because I bet you they'll run away, almost instantly. So I don't think we're ready to be legal. And then the other question is this, which is, what does it even mean to be legal? Like, where do you want to be legal in? Like, you know, there are 200 plus countries in the world. Which, pick a jurisdiction that you think, yeah, I agree with all these laws, and that's great. And then watch it completely, like, you know, where you want to be legal in both, you know, the US and Iran. And what about Turkey? And what about Pakistan? And what about Egypt? I can keep going all day long with all
this stuff. I mean, your anecdote of you being in Turkey, actually. And can you just kind of...
Yeah, I was in...
Go ahead.
In Turkey, trying to research, what I was trying to write, and just, you know, check on some of the terms. And I was trying to look on, you know, Max Weber's interpretation on the monopoly on violence. And, you know, the first place you start usually is, I didn't have my books with me, is Wikipedia. And, of course, Wikipedia is banned in Turkey. Actually, that's a great example of what I'm then, you know, go on to argue, which is this. Look, don't try in a sense and be legal. It's impossible to do, and it's not what you really want, and you're not ready for this as a community. And isn't the great power, isn't the great power in Zabel's law this, which is that when he says, look, hands up, I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do because the code runs autonomously. Code is law, it just runs autonomously, it runs by itself. And so I'm sorry, you're just going to have to go away. There's nothing we can do. Isn't the great power in that, that when the state comes to you and says, please, you need to change this because this is what the court says, then who do they look for to implement that, right? Where are the humans that they can put in prison to say, well, if you don't do what we want you to do, you're going to go to jail, buddy, or we're going to take your house away, right? If they can't find those people to start with, then they look ridiculous. And this is, in a sense, what Turkey tried to do with Wikipedia. Wikipedia, like, you know, Turkey wanted, the government of Turkey wanted, a couple of Wikipedia pages removed. And they're like, you don't really understand. So they go to the Wikipedia page and they remove them. And Wikipedia goes, we don't work like this. Like, right. Do you know how Wikipedia works? And they go, well, we don't care. We want you to remove it. So they just ban all of Wikipedia. That's what they had to do.
And just to bring that full circle, Erdogan was actually, I just thought of this now. I'm not sure how relevant it is to our discussion, but kind of an interesting synchronicitous, sort of bit of trivia. Erdogan has been using the video of the New Zealand mosque shooter as sort of a rallying cry, while the New Zealanders are, the government there is trying to suppress it actively by actually, sending people to jail for even, distributing it online. And here it is that here it is Erdogan is getting up and talking about, look, watch this. This is our, trying to get right. And yet they're suppressing Wikipedia. It's more than ironic, but as you're sitting there and you're trying to do research on Weber, something interesting happens, right? So someone comes over to you.
Right. And actually, so I'm researching this and I can't get the Wikipedia page to come up, and I'd been there the year and a half before and I didn't actually realize that it was now banned in that intervening period. So I was like, I kept trying, and the hotel manager came up to me, and I know her well enough, and she just gave me this cartoon from The Economist about freedom of speech. And I looked at it and I was like, okay, this is weird. I'm eating my breakfast. Why are you giving this to me? And she's like, look, isn't this funny? Ha 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 ha. And she was laughing very nervously. And she's not a nervous woman. She's a very strong, capable woman who runs a hotel. And I realized what was going on. And I just stopped because I, again, what's that moment where you're like, do I want to, I believe in freedom. I'll set up a VPN. I'll get around it somehow. Set up a mirror Wikipedia site. Like, I can sort of maybe try and do that. But I don't want to get not just me in trouble. I don't really want to go to prison while I'm like trying to write some stuff, but I don't want to get the hotel manager in trouble either. Now, and potentially anyone I know. And that is the monopoly on violence, right? The state gets to do that because they're in charge of the guns and the police and the army. And, and I start to sound very high libertarian. And I'm not someone, I'm not like a big, I don't live in America. So maybe if I did, I would be slightly different, but I'm not a big, like, oh, we all need to have AR-15s in our basement.
Right. That's the next point I was going to get into, is that you're not part of the Ron Paul brigade.
No. There.
I saw some of the anti-Brexit stuff and I was cracking up. Because I think people are gonna, if they just listen to the first part of the show, they're gonna be, he's got another anarchist, right wing, libertarian. You're about as far away from that as anybody can get. But you're that's why I think your point is so powerful, because in the United States, I forgot his name. Oh well, Fareed Zakaria, who is a very well known CNN kind of mainstream journalist. Known for international flair. He's debonair, cosmopolitan. He's got all the right opinions. And he, a couple of weeks ago on his show GPS, he came to the realization. He was like, maybe we went a little too far by cheerleading all these executive orders during the last 10 years or during the last 8 years during the Obama administration and handing over so much power to the executive branch, because now it's coming back to haunt us. And I think there's a natural alliance between and I called you on Twitter, kind of the old lovable progressives that I remember, that are free speech, that are open to the, you know. So I want a go-go capitalist, you know, dog, I'm joking, but dog-eat-dog and Ayn Randian world. You want the cooperatives, but in between, we both have a common enemy, and that is the state in the sense that you're speaking of it here. So,
I mean, look, that's exactly right. I mean, like, I, this is where I think, like, cooperatives for me, like, symbolize everything I stand for in many senses, because no one's forcing you to cooperate, right?
Right. Right?
You can be part of something, it's a mutual venture, right? It's actually an archaic term almost, mutual ventures. But for me, it means everything about respect between peers, right? You know, we have this, the technical expression, peer-to-peer, right? But for me, again, like a cooperative is just that, peer-to-peer. Like we stand equal, and that means respect, right? It means I can't do to you what you otherwise wouldn't do. And so I don't have more power over you than you have over me. And I like systems where that's the case. But I also acknowledge, and this is why I'm not just like a high libertarian, that people need to cooperate, and that much, much good can come of cooperation within the framework of mutual venture. Then can be done just by simply living an atomized life with maybe a small family unit at most. So I'm not an Ayn Randian. I like my fellow human beings. I don't inherently mistrust them. And I know that some problems are, in fact, can only be solved mutually.
I'm laughing not at you. I'm laughing at the caricature because of a Randian. But you're absolutely right. So there is. That's neither here nor there. I was going to get into the whole capitalism is not about, you know, competition, it's about cooperation, but that's a whole nother topic. I think because when you were talking about before, they were trying to take my property. I want to jump right in and go, say that again. They're trying to take your what? Your property.
Yeah. I know, and I can hear myself saying it, and I know what, in a sense, that can also sound like, but that is, that's literally what they were doing, right? These things are physical, they were taking away from me.
And to their the logical conclusion, you know, which some people go, come on, it's just, you know, Malik, it's just, you know, these are papers, and who gives a crap? This guy's a probably no good terrorist. Just do this. You know, who cares about your silly principles? To their logical conclusion, though, they take the right to physically kidnap you. And that's, I'm not being hyperbolic. I'm not exaggerating. That was the choice in your case. We've been through the whole dance now, Shiv. We've humored you, right? We've checked ourselves. We found that we're doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. Cooperate or your ass will sit in that cell for as long as it takes. And I do believe that really is, because it's such an abstraction to a lot of people, especially who are well off enough to dabble in crypto. It's such an abstraction to them that they can sort of cavalierly go about this as an intellectual exercise. But I think, and you have, and this wasn't the first time, as you said, that you've come up against state violence. So hear for your... for your bravery in bringing attention to this. And I said I would keep you for half an hour, and I've gone way over that. So you've got a book coming out called The Messenger, right?
It's coming out in June. It retails some of this story about the police coming to my house, but then there's a really interesting twist at the end of it. Mm-hmm. It might also end up being a podcast. Maybe watch out for that. It would be nice if that happens. I think that actually got signed today, so that was good. It looks like it's going ahead. If I could leave with one small story. And it's kind of how I end the piece, and it's this, which is, you know, about 2,500 years ago. If you've ever seen the movie 300, you probably know roughly what this is I'm talking about. You know, Xerxes tries to invade Greece, there's a story from Herodotus, which is where the most of the source material for this comes from, And he tells his story sort of dripping with sarcasm and mockery. And he says this, that the Xerxes, the bridge that they were using to cross the Dardanelles, the Hellespont as it was known then, was washed away in a storm. And Xerxes gets infuriatingly mad. You know, he's got a million men in his back, all ready to go into Greece, and his bridge gets washed away. So he orders his men to whip and brand the waters, right? Whilst chanting, you know, oh, waters, you know, how you bedeviled me, you are evil, and you're turbid and briny, and you'll never, you know, no one will ever give you sacrifices. It's ridiculous, right? It's ridiculous. Because, and Herodotus knows it's ridiculous, and actually Herodotus' histories were not read, they were read out aloud, and so the audience, you can hear them laughing along to this story. You're like, what an idiot, right? The king thinks he's above nature. You can't whip waters into punishment. And that's how I feel like the crypto community should be. We should be just like nature. We should be like the waters of the Hellespont in that story. Like, if the, when kings and courts come to jail us and to whip us, not them, not, they shouldn't just fail. They should look ridiculous even trying.
Woo! Preach, Jim, preach! Damn! you just wiped away entire libraries of friggin' judicial nonsense. That was, it's overly ironic because as I finished your piece a couple days back, I sat back because you end that way as well. And I said, that is just beautiful. We need more poets. You know, I can't say enough good things, and it's just going to sound gushing. And I,
oh man, that's really kind. That's really kind. You know, and that's true. Actually, you need, you know, a lot of these things are just like through a bit of poetry, and I learned that from other people, and I do it really badly. But there's lots to be learned on all of this from history. History, every people have lived this before, like, you know, over and over again. You just got to read a bit more, and it's all there.
And lastly, you're not saying to violate the law. You're saying to go about your business in a way that is water-like, that although these man-made structures build up and they try to contain things, you know, light finds a way, water finds a way, you know, to this natural progression of things to be so flexible, so malleable, and the sort of the plausible deniability of it all, to take Szabo to maybe a point at which he didn't even realize that really is the only way to stand up to a monopoly of violence is to give it no quarter at all.
Exactly right. Right. The code runs autonomously, and so does the river. That's it.
Boom. Well, thanks again. Where can we find your work, man? I know a lot of people are going to want to jump on and follow you. So where can we follow you?
I do a lot of my publishing through the Streamer blog, so I'll have a few more things out through there. But otherwise, I'm on Twitter, Shiv Malik. Anything new that comes out is usually on there, at Shiv Malik. Thanks for having me, man. Really, really enjoyed this a lot. It was a great discussion. I really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. I learned a ton, and thanks again.